he's still in the way in person.
Good afternoon, everyone. And with that gavel, I will convene the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development on today, the 22nd of February. For those that have been waiting patiently, I apologize for the delay. It's that time in session where people are torn in a dozen different directions, and we have managed to pull a quorum together. We have two bills in work session and an informational hearing. I'm going to open up, and I'm just going to exercise the chair's prerogative in deference to one of the members that is visiting with us today. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 1506 relating to Oregon Wounded Warrior parking permits. And I'll ask the professional staff to give us a little background as anybody who wants to testify moves forward to the front table.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 1506 requires the Department of Transportation to issue a new parking permit known as the Oregon Wounded Warrior permit. It is the permit would allow the holder to park for free in a metered or time-limited public parking space without penalty. The measure takes effect upon passage, and ODOT is required to begin issuing the new permits on January 1st, 2019. The LFO recommends that Senate Bill 1506 be moved to the Ways and Means full committee.
Welcome, Senator Manning.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, and the committee is indeed an honor, and it looks a little different from this side of the bench, seeing that everyone up there that I'm on the on the bench later on. Anyway, thank you so much. My name is, for the record, James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am the senator from District 7, which is Northwest Eugene, up to Junction City, and I got a marvelous agricultural community in between. So I have a very unique and robust district, and I'm really proud of that and proud to serve the people of that district. This bill, well, just to kind of give you a little context about the bill, currently in Oregon, we have over 133,000 veterans and counting. In my district alone, we have over 30,000. What this bill has done, or it's the intent of the bill, is that we now know that during the current Gulf Wars that we've had, we are soldiers and sailors and airmen and military veterans are coming back with double, triple amputees. And not always is a handicapped parking designated spot most convenient for them to go on a medical appointment or whatever they have to do to take care of. This bill is specific because it requires our veterans to go an extra layer in terms of how they prove that they qualify for one of these permits. In other words, whereas anyone else have to go to a doctor, and the doctor, and they meet the qualifications, the doctor writes it up on a slip, they take it over to the DMV, and based on the qualification, they're issued one of these park permits. In Eugene, if you have a handicapped parking placard, regardless of who you are, you can park at a parking meter at no cost. I realize that there are a couple of cities here in the state and perhaps more that do charge even if you have a handicapped parking placard. I will reserve my comments and my thoughts about that because that's not a way to fund a city. We have received the endorsement of the League of Cities in support of this measure. So I'm really proud to have that. So the bill itself is one that is really small in comparison to the sacrifices our veterans have made. We've got World War II veterans that are aging. We have Korean War veterans that are aging. And let's not forget our Vietnam War veterans that are here and they're still having problems, Agent Orange and other issues. And now we have a whole set of new veterans that are coming back with different types of amputees, amputations, arms, legs. This is a very small, say, we want to make improve the quality of life for you. And it's not going to cost an arm and a leg, literally. It's something that I think that we can all be proud of. And it's just a small gesture to say thank you for your service and your sacrifice. So I hope this committee feels it necessary to move this bill forward. It is a good bill.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the Senator? Senator Johnson.
I actually have two. And I agree with everything that the witness has said, but two questions.
One of them is downtown Portland has just changed their practice. They used to allow unlimited parking with handicap permits. Do you, and I believe that it was Commissioner Novak, a handicapped individual himself, who championed limiting the time downtown. What will be the juxtaposition between the passage of this bill and the Portland ordinance that changes their parking with handicap permits downtown? Will we trump? Or has the city of Portland said anything complaining about this bill?
Well, when the president of the League of Oregon Cities contacted me, he said that all of the cities were on board with this, okay, and they support it.
And my second question is what effect this would have on other parking facilities, for example, Snow Park or some of the up at government camp or any of the other parking lots. Does it have to be a metered site?
No, it can be anywhere that public parking is permitted, and they're limited to, just like anyone else, you and I are driving, whatever parking is available by the public.
Okay, my question is one of the impact. I know this is a small and honorable group of folks. My question is there any significant impact to the snow park permits that are used, I think, to maintain Mount Hood parking lots? And it's, for me, it's just a question of, have we dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's before we pass this? And are there fiscal impacts to others? Ms. Joyce might know. I don't, ODOT doesn't run Snow Park, though, I don't think, do you?
Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Chairs Gomberg and Johnson and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Indeed, we do run Snow Park. Senator Johnson, this is an interesting question I had not considered before, whether the disabled person parking placards broadly can be used in a snow park. I don't know the answer to that, but what I would say is that if they, the Wounded Warrior sticker wouldn't really change anything about the existing law vis-a-vis snow parks. So if they're, the current law allows free parking unless a city says no, and so the state hasn't said no. If the state hasn't said no about snow parks, which we haven't as far as I know, I apologize for the word salad. I think the answer is it really shouldn't have an impact as far as I can tell.
Okay.
And may I chime in? You know, anywhere that parking is prohibited, then the same rules apply. So they're not getting any special treatments in that sense.
Ms. Joyce, as long as you're here as a target of opportunity, could you help me understand the distinction between a disabled parking permit and a Wounded Warrior permit?
Chair Gomberg, for a person to qualify for the Wounded Warrior program under this bill, the individual already has to qualify for a disabled person parking permit. So it's sort of a next level benefit that's added. Mm-hmm. So for a person with a standard parking permit, they could add this, and then it gets you that extra benefit, trumps the local jurisdiction, as Senator Johnson indicated. So yes, it would trump the situation in Portland, because that's how the bill is written. It elevates it. And then the other type of placard we have is the wheelchair user only placard, which is for people who require a wheelchair, and then only folks with that placard can park in that spot. The Wounded Warrior doesn't get you into that spot, but that's what.
And somebody had made reference to a Wounded Warrior sticker. Is this is a portable placard, or is it a more permanent indication affixed to a vehicle?
Chair Gomber, the current parking placard program is it's a movable placard that you hang from your rear view mirror. The way that DMV has decided to implement this to keep costs very low is to add a sticker to an existing placard to indicate that sort of up benefit. So that keeps the cost very low instead of creating all new placards and all this kind of thing.
And last question I have for you, as heinous as this might be, is what penalties might be in place for someone who would abuse one of these stickers having not earned the right to use it?
Chair Gomberg, I don't know the exact penalty, but it is a violation of the vehicle code to inappropriately use any kind of disabled person parking placard. So it's the same thing as if you borrowed your friend's parking placard and hung it in your car, the same kind of penalty.
Thank you very much. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just for clarification, Amy, if I understand the way this is written and what you testified, disabled parking is one, and then this Wounded Warrior placard essentially gives the same priority as wheelchair parking or a wheelchair placard in trumping municipal ordinances in parking. Is that, as I'm reading the current law and the proposal?
Chair Gomberg and Representative Noble, that is true, except that you cannot park in a wheelchair user only
right.
spot unless the underlying
placard unless you have
is
a
wheelchair user only, right? Mm.
Thank you. Any other questions?
May I just add also for the veterans that is trying or seeking this, they have to show proof from VA of their disability, which is a level higher than anyone else would. So it is more they have to provide more verification. So it does take it up for them to qualify for this. I don't see a bunch of veterans that's going to be coming out trying to get one of these placards. Most veterans won't even apply for their own benefits. So this is going to be really small. But then, you know, we look at how it will improve quality of life for a few veterans that choose to do this with these disabilities.
Thank you again, Senator, and thank you very much for bringing this measure forward to us.
Thank you.
Greg, you had indicated earlier your recommendation. I wonder if I could have you repeat that for us at this point.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. The measure is anticipated to have a minimal fiscal impact, and the LFO recommends that Senate Bill 1506 be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Co-Chair,
please.
I would move the LFO recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion. You've heard the discussion. Is there any further commentary, or are we ready to vote? In that case, I would ask if there are any objections. Seeing none. Motion carries. I believe we need carriers to full and carrier to both floors.
May I respectfully suggest Senator Manning?
Senator Manning, if you could take this to full Ways and Means and to the Senate floor. And Representative Reardon would be happy to carry this on the House floor. All right. Any further business for us regarding 1506? I will close that work session. I will open up a work session on House Bill 4010A relating to home ownership. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, the next item on your agenda is House Bill 4010. It establishes an 11-member task force on addressing racial disparities in home ownership. The task force is charged with making recommendations for changes in lending practices to eliminate discrimination and remove barriers to home ownership for people of color in Oregon. It requires the task force to report back to the legislature by September 15, 2019, and the task force sunsets on December 31, 2019. It's had previous hearings in the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on February 8th and 9th, and the fiscal impact is anticipated to be minimal. The bill requires the Legislative Policy and Research Office to provide staffing support to the task force, and the 17-19 legislative branch budget should contain the funds to support this task force.
Thank you very much. I don't see any sponsor.
I'm the sponsor,
oh,
Chair,
well,
Co-Chair.
Then
but,
I do see one
I'm
of the sponsors.
I'm just here to answer questions. It's a really good bill. Should pass. No,
Senator Johnson.
I guess I have a comment and a question. This is an issue that's been studied at length. The Fed does a report. Many banks do a report. It, in some respects, seems to me to be redundant. And I guess what's the underlying purpose? What are we trying to find out? We all know there's a problem. Mm-hmm. This is going to cost something. I'd rather apply the cost of the task force to doing something rather than reinforcing what we already know. So what are you trying to get at?
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. You hit the nail on the head that we know there's a problem. But the cost, the minimal cost that this savings you would save by not doing this task force will not get us any closer to solving it. What is at issue here is that if you look at home ownership in the state of Oregon, about 60% of folks, single folks, 67% of non-Hispanic white households own a home in Oregon. And actually, that is probably a little bit lower than nationwide. But when it comes to Native American households, Latino households, and black households in Oregon, of the percentage of the folks in our community, in our state, only 34% of black households own a home in Oregon. And there is, you mentioned research. I am not familiar with research that directly studies. We know, and it's been recognized and accepted that we've had a discrimination problem in the state of Oregon for many years, dating back to the 50s. And we're currently working on a bill that would eliminate some of these covenants and restrictions that identify some of these issues. I believe that this task force will help bring in some industry experts that are related to whether it's predatory financing, discriminatory practices, that we can get to a really a good solid question related directly to Oregon and Oregon buyers and homeowners, what the issues are and how we can make a respond to it next year.
Can I grind on this a second more? Are you envisioning flying in national experts? Or are we going to draw on local experts? Because you're tapping into budgets that already, in some people's opinion, are constrained.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. No, we have local experts both in the finance industry, in the mortgage industry, and we want part of the task force makeup will be all volunteers, and basically, we want to have the issue discussed among them and to potentially procure research, but not at the expense of the state, but to really better come to a better understanding and glean from any current resources or research analysis that is out there to determine how some of our issues can be resolved.
Last question. These task forces, leave aside the subject matter, any task force, ends up bugging me when there's not some embedded ability to keep them balanced. The legislature has created, in my observation, a few too many task forces that have a predetermined outcome, and that's why I'm setting aside the subject matter here. But you said lending institutions, I presume that you... we'll take some pains to make sure that this is balanced, assuming that the purpose of the task force is to recommend legislation?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. The task force will be made up of 11 members, four appointees from both the Senate side and the Speaker, seven others that would represent the industry. One would represent real estate industry, another would represent the funding mortgage industry. One member would be represent an organization that particularly focuses on housing in the state of Oregon, similar to, let's say, NEDCO or the Housing Associates. I can't think of the names of those folks.
Housing Alliance.
Housing Alliance. Thank you, sir. And then four members who represent Oregon residents who have suffered historic discrimination. So we get both their expert input and also most likely anecdotal and then professional advice from the real estate industry also.
One last question with your indulgence.
Please, Senator.
Where's rural Oregon in this?
They are.
I mean, is there going to be some assurance that Southern Oregon and the coast and places that are outside of the I-5 corridor will end up being represented?
Co-Chair Johnson, unfortunately, the folks that I mentioned in here, whether Native American, Hispanic, they don't all live in the Portland metro area. And my hope and goal is that the representing bodies or the Senate President and the Speaker of the House will make really good effective appointments that would represent both the rural and populated areas of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative Meek. Senator Manning, I see you are still with us, and I note that you are a chief sponsor of this measure. If you'd like to share something with us very quickly, we welcome that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, James Ivory Manning, Jr., Senator District 7, Eugene, Junction City, and agricultural community in between. Representative Meek, thank you so much. I think that you characterized the intent and the direction of this task force very, very well. I'm not sure there are very much that any more that I can actually add to this, except that we're at a part right now where the housing crisis has caused us to expand and to try to figure out why are we consistently in this position in terms of affordable housing, home ownership. And it continues to go on. It was mentioned they began back in the 50s, redlining and all that, and we continue to struggle in this area. So this task force could uncover a lot of other things in the rural communities, because my area in particular is urban and rural. So I have I'm very much interested in the outcome of this and what it's going to bring. I will also be inviting people from Junction City and some of the rural areas in Lane County to come up and provide some type of testimony or be a part of the process. Because I agree with Co-Chair Johnson that we have to have representation from all over and not just in the populated areas or the urban centers.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, Senator Johnson.
I would hope that some of the people that the sponsors of the bill are encouraging to be participatory might also be looking at the constraint of land. If you make a product scarcer, it gets more expensive. And I think for many communities, the paucity of developable land is a contributory factor to driving prices sky high.
I completely agree with you, Senator Johnson. And Eugene itself, I think legislative session in the Senate, we promoted some legislation to allow counties and municipalities to re-examine their urban growth boundaries, what those look like. Those are going to be held at the local levels. I understand that, and I think that's a good thing. But all of that has to come into context. I agree with you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any further? Yes, Representative Bearden.
Well, just more of a comment, if I may. I'm just looking over the list of bill sponsors. And I noticed nobody from east of the Cascade, so it sort of follows up on, and that's pretty rural. I checked last October. I would hope that they would invite somebody from Ontario. They're right on the river, next to Idaho. They have their own unique set of challenges. And so that'd be my suggestion for this group, to really include the east side. Their housing issues are different, but just as challenging as they are in our more urban areas. So,
Representative Ritter, I do agree with you. I've talked with people out in the Pendleton area, yep. And they have concerns as well. So it is a widespread, and the intent is to get as many people together to discuss this so we can come up with, develop some type of solution, hopefully, because the housing crisis that we have right now can't continue. It's going to go to get worse. So. I think it's a good time for this task force, and I would encourage you to ask you that you would vote yes to move it.
Thank you again very much, Senator.
Thank you.
Colleagues, if there's no further questions, I'm going to ask Ms. Toe to reiterate her recommendation.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, LFO recommends that House Bill 4010 be moved to the full Ways and Means.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Co-chair, I would move the LFO recommendation.
Thank you. Colleagues, you've heard that motion. Is there discussion? I have a question, and I'll ask Representative Meek, with your professional background as well as your legislative interest in this subject. The focus here is on home ownership.
Yes, sir.
And one of the things that we've begun to understand is that we also have a problem here in Oregon with people who already own homes, but those homes are deteriorating and they don't have the ability to make necessary repairs. Would the mortgages that are focused on in this bill also apply to second mortgages that could be used for home repairs, or are we talking simply about first-time home buyers?
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg. That is exactly what we're talking about, because when we talk about predatory practices, there are folks that lived in the inner north, northeast portions of Portland that were given mortgages and or credit lines to repair their homes and probably given a little bit more than they should have or could afford and end up through the process of the recession losing their homes in foreclosure. And part of the mortgage practice that we want to have addressed and looked at is to find out making sure that certain segments of our communities are not being targeted for these predatory practices and find ways to eliminate them.
Thank you. I wanted to get part of that on the record as well. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll ask if there are objections. And seeing none, no objections, the motion carries. And we need carriers to full and to both floors. Is that correct? Senator Monroe would
I'd be happy to carry it to full. You want me to carry it in the Senate as well, or do you want
I've got Senator Manning here as well, to the Senate.
Okay.
Would you
I'd
defer
be happy to share responsibilities with my friend.
All right, so we'll have co-carriers on the Senate floor. And Representative Meek?
We've already been through the House. Oh, no, it is. Yes, okay, I'm sorry. Please, I would love to be the
You gave me pause to think.
I know, it was a different bill I was thinking about. But
we've been through the House committee.
There are too many. That's why you got confused.
Representative Meek, would you and Representative Bynum like to co-carry this? Would that be appropriate? She's another principal?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Coach.
Excellent.
And Co-Chair, I asked for leave. I had talking about affordable housing. I need to go present a bill over in the Senate committee.
I think you will still leave us with a quorum. So,
if you open your information session, I think you can continue it. But I've got a meeting.
All right. Well, then we're going to close the work session on 4010. We were going to open the information meeting that we have scheduled. And since we have a quorum when I opened it, if some of you have conflicts, I will note that you are excused. Ms. Deister.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi. Today before you, we are talking about potential changes to the legislatively adopted budget of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Some of those things you'll be hearing about are a result of legislation that passed towards the end of the 2017 session. A couple of those bills didn't actually make their way down to Ways and Means, and so were not accommodated in the agency's expenditure limitation. And a couple of them that OLCC would like to make you aware of are just issues that have come up since then, or issues that we knew about then but weren't quite ready for prime time. And I think just an overview of sort of where the agency stands in terms of its budget and its challenges would be helpful for this committee as we continue to track them through with the rest of the biennium.
Mr. Marks. Your budget and its challenges. Welcome to all of you.
No, I'm good. Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. With me is Bill Schutte, formerly our economist, currently our Chief Financial Officer, new to the position. We're glad to have Bill assume that role for us. And then with us is Patrick Heath from DAS Budget Management. I would also introduce our chair, Chairman Paul Rosenbaum, is in the back of the room. Been with the commission now for 4 months, 6 months?
I think it's closer to three.
Okay. Thank you. So with that, we're looking at a high-level overview on what we do to remind you. You are all well engaged in this. Look at the growth we're experiencing. We want to point out that growth to you because it is significant. And then we'll do a brief budget overview, and Bill will cover some of the details of our items moving forward.
Mr. Marks, before you get into the depth of your presentation, just a question. Michael, did they give you any indication when they were going to fix that microphone?
I thought they did yesterday.
Would you call them, bug them again?
Yes, ma'am.
Please, respectfully.
Thank you.
And for those listening at home, we're getting a warbling effect. It seems like we're getting it on both microphones now.
Yeah.
Yep. Suggesting I move it back. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good. With the overview, I want to remind you of our core functions. Our core functions, we, you know, centrally purchase alcohol. We distribute it, distilled spirits throughout Oregon. We license and regulate our alcohol licenses and alcohol server permits. We administer the bottle bill, which has been, it's developing into a program inside. Initially, we only designated or signed off on the locations of sites for the redemption centers, but we're getting more and more responsibilities to communicate that program outward and our responsibilities for regulating it. We have new licensing responsibilities for marijuana licenses and for worker permits. New responsibilities coming on shortly here in the next several months to track and inspect Oregon Health Authority growers of 12 plants or more. That was legislation in 16 that we are, 17, that we are moving forward with in the next few months to be able to track those growers.
Senator Johnson.
You're purely a target of opportunity for me to say this, but as long as you're now becoming part of the face of the bottle bill, how much communication is there between cities and OLCC in terms of accommodating the redemption centers? And the reason that I ask is there are full-fledged redemption centers, and then there are sort of in-store, and then there are kind of outside mini-redemption. And twice now, I've run into problems in my district where municipalities are saying the mini isn't tethered to the ground adequately. And as all I'm doing is not working the issue here, but just suggesting that some conversation between OBRC, you guys, and municipalities to make the placement of these centers easier rather than harder would be helpful. That's the only
thing. Very good. Appreciate that. I hadn't heard that specific issue, but we're in constant contact with OBRC, and that will be something we bring up with them.
Just mention Safeway to Jules Bailey,
okay,
and
we'll do
he'll know what a hard time we had getting that cited.
Very good. So we're going to be tracking the new OHA growers, and that's going to come on very rapidly into our system. A great development for state's overall regulation of marijuana to finally have these medical growers tracked and identified in the system. Remind you, we're the third largest generator of public funds. Alcohol side in this biennium is expected to generate $574 million. Marijuana is expected to generate $150 million in this biennium. To remind you, our recreational marijuana program is fee-funded, paid for by the licensees themselves. The OHA medical tracking is going to be funded from the administrative fund, marijuana administrative fund associated with the Department of Revenue. So it's out of the tax pre-distribution tax dollars. Just to belabor, I think, a bit on this slide for you, we've been growing really rapidly over the past 3 years. We started off 3 years ago with 230 positions. We're now up to 304. With the actions that we're talking about in this budget, we'll be closer to 320. Next biennium, I expect a significant continued growth in personnel moving forward. We've had nearly 200 administrative actions having to do with positions, so 94 new personnel. 81 of our employees are new to their position. A lot of them, I think you know, have went from alcohol to the marijuana program. So we've had many activities in terms of recruitment and hiring to move forward. It's been we're getting very good at production employment, and our roles and responsibilities of folks as we have taken on and learned more about where we're regulating in the marijuana world are expanding. So, you know, it's going to be an issue for us to make sure that we have in place the personnel to properly manage the program and operate the program going into the future. We were confronted both in 2015 and 2016 and in 2017 with major revisions to the marijuana statutes. Again, in this session, we'll have more targeted, but revisions coming forward. We have new license types, new privileges. New rulemaking, and each step along the way of that means we got to draft the rules, form the advisory committees, figure out who's going to do the work, change the metric tracking system, maybe make changes to our licensing system, and it's been a constant progression for us. We have put in place the online marijuana licensing system and the online worker permit system for cannabis and the cannabis tracking system. All along the way here now, as we've, you know, sort of in real time developed rules, hired staff, and put them out in the field, we need to take the moments to be able to put in place our processes and procedures for some of these things. So we're out there regulating and inspecting, but it's a big difference between having the clarity of a procedure where you know what you're looking for, you know what evidence makes the cases when you're looking at particular kinds of licensing operations and our oversight responsibilities for violations. And then the growth of marijuana licensing and enforcement, certainly all the estimates have been outstripped over this 3-year period. Initially, we thought there'd be 1,200 applications. We've received, you know, nearly 3,500 applications. Our initial estimate was that we'd have like 800 licensees throughout the system. We're now at over 1,700. And initially, we thought the worker permits would be 4,000. Now that did only apply to retail when that first estimate is made. Handlers of marijuana at every stage of licensing are now required to have a worker's permit.
Are you keeping track of the enforcement actions?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, yes, we are keeping track of the enforcement actions. I can get you those numbers, but we have two sets of things. We have charges in moving forward, which is a larger number, and then we have those things that go through the administrative process that are being completed or are completed. So we have, I will bring you back the charges that we've made. It's not a tremendous number of cases right now. I think we're in the range of 40 completed, maybe like 150 in progress. This is going to be an intense area of growth for us as we go forward on these. We are going to be writing a lot more violations in the near future. And then the process does take time. So we are keeping track of that. We're keeping track of not just the violations, but we're also keeping track. You provided the opportunity for staffing. So we had a call center so we could make referrals to the appropriate city, county, police department or reference or OHA to make sure that we knew where marijuana was coming from and for receiving complaints or tips of criminal activity or violations of our rules. That's ongoing. I think in total, I'm going to be speaking from my memory here, so I'll get you the exact numbers, but I think there's something like 550 to 1,000 on that list. A lot of those are very minor referrals, but we have a whole group that go back to the 45-day dry period of marijuana that are being pursued and investigated. We have another significant group in the, I'd say, 50 item range that are turned over for other investigations, and we still have them open. Maybe criminal referrals on those.
Thank you.
We're having to do a lot of education every time the licensing changes, and with all these new applicants, that's an ongoing process, not just for our inspectors, but also for the licensees that come into the system. So it's a constant for us. It's very important, both training and that education, and so is constant communication for getting the compliance. Communication is really driving a lot of the compliance that we're getting. It's an important part, I think, one of the most important aspects of us moving forward successfully with our regulatory structure. We've had 5.7 million hits on our website, contacts on the website, and that is a lot. We have 91,000 subscribers to GitGov delivery that we can communicate with. that. Budget challenges. We have system-wide technology challenges. So we've spent a lot of time talking with members of the committee about these challenges. Some of these are operational needs for us now. These are items that we are moving forward or will hope to see move forward in the end of session bill. The chief information officer, highest among them, you know, is very interested in trying to secure that position during the last session. We have a response to our audit and near-term redundancy for our IT systems, but we also want to identify here that there are operational reasons that we need the new servers in place, separate and distinct from the necessity to have redundancy in our IT systems. We have, under the requirements of DAS, are now extending they have renewed the contract for SAP software, and we're having to engage in increasing our costs and compliance with that contract. And we are moving forward with the online privileged tax reporting system for beer and wine. We had hoped to come to this session, I think, looking for the initial funding to, not the initial funding to move it, the funding to move that project forward. We did an RFI. We didn't get extensive reviews, so we intend to issue an RFP so that we can come back to you with an actual cost of what it looks like to move that system forward. We have OHA medical tracking I've talked about. We're adding 13 regulatory specialists. That is targeted at this point to service about 2,000 medical growers. We figured about one specialist per 150 sites, grow sites on that. And then we're passing through, got some limitation on monies coming from OHA to modify the metric tracking system so that the system can actually take into account the tracking that the medical growers will have to do within metric. It's very similar to the tracking that we have otherwise, but this funding is limitation, and it wasn't in our initial request letter. It is literally pass-through money from OHA that we put into modifying the metric tracking system to service this tracking that we need to do here. Then we have marijuana licensing and renewal support. We are asking for administrative support for our licensing division. For the folks that are working there, particularly in marijuana, we have built a good online licensing system that got the job done for us with getting licenses out, but with changes in the statutes all along the way, we didn't fully anticipate the complexities that we'd have to be engaged in with renewals, so the system doesn't really incorporate renewals seamlessly. So we're going to have to continue to work on that. These positions that we're asking for here will help us do the manual part of the work that we need to do on renewals and provide some relief to the unit that has been most pressed over these 3 years. Licensing has just been hard on it from year one all the way through.
Mr. Marks, how do you assure equity in your licensing system? You've been behind. You just made mention that the staff has been pretty hard pressed to keep up with the unanticipated demand. Yeah. How do you assure that if you came into the queue at number 30, that you're actually served as number 30 and that there isn't political influence to move you to number 11? Or what's the integrity of the, you know, served when arrived kind of thing? And I'm thinking about legislators who, in the zealous support of their constituents, might want to call and hammer on you about having their certain grow dealt with more quickly than others.
So let me say, while we have a general sort of water law, first in time, first in right approach to this, that's not rigorous. We have been flexible. We've dealt with problems in licensing, the businesses themselves that have had immediacy needs to move their licensing forward. We have
Who's the final arbiter of that immediacy need?
In most cases, it is the head of the licensing division who makes the call on whether they move forward and how they move forward. In fact, even when I get calls and suggest them down, they are so busy, it's very hard to move someone forward in our system today. So we've done it in cases where maybe we're transferring, people are transferring licenses, need to change licenses because their business is going, and to make the marijuana legal on site, we need to accommodate that so that it doesn't have any gaps in the legality of their license status.
Well, I say this respectfully, that one of the criticisms that I had heard from the hospitality industry was how far behind you were, and that there would be instances where a bar, for example, was trying to change ownership. And I think that you have to be absolutely transparent in how you deal with those expedited cases. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to have an audit reveal that there was, you know, some geographic part of the state that got preferential attention, or, you know, people that were advocates of the industry having their folks moved forward. I think you have to remain vigilant to make sure that there's equity, because if your system begins to suffer from the corrosive acid drip of people's belief in the integrity of government with this many licensees, I think you're going to be in a world of hurt. And if it spills over into the booze world or vice versa, I think you could be subject to criticism if there's any chance of proving that there was preferential treatment anywhere.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, very true. And
remind me of that the next time I call and bang on you about one of my constituents.
I was thinking that while I was sitting here.
I could read your mind. You should not play poker.
but I will say, I think it's an important value for our system to be practical about when we move these things forward, and when it's important to do for practical reasons, not just because someone know someone, but because there's a business reason for the organization to get it done. And we've expedited those, and we've made those work, and we've been flexible and adaptable in making that happen as we communicate with our licensees about the expectations of timing generally. And just to make sure I'm communicating that here today, with these positions that you're adding that are helping with renewals, helping with licensing overall, this isn't going to speed up the issuance of marijuana licenses. We're running about 6 months, and I anticipate for the remainder of the biennium, it will be about on average 6 months. We're not going to make great gains on that. We will make gains on getting our renewals done. We will make gains advancing the ability of our license inspectors to be able to understand the procedures in place with new rules that are coming forward, and those are happening currently all along the way here. So we'll use some of them to help develop some of the educational and procedures that we don't have in place. And some of those procedures will help precisely with your question of how things move forward in the system.
Mr. Chair, please. One other question. I would hope that all of the agencies that rely on background checks continue to talk to each other and support each other in adequate funding to make sure those functions happen. I don't care whether it's somebody coming out of cosmetology school who wants to get a background check so they can go to work in a salon, or it's a dope dealer, or a dope grower, or a little misstep there, or a bar owner, making sure that we as the state have the infrastructure to process these business people is really important. And I don't know at what point the background guys get so overwhelmed, particularly with the redundancy of background checks. I use my example of a cosmetologist. If you're a volunteer at school, you're a hairdresser, you maybe help with your kid's softball, you could be subject to multiple background checks. And Co-Chair Nathanson and I took a run at trying to reduce the number of touches where a citizen would have to get a background check. Sure. And found it astonishingly complicated with a plethora of pushback. But I just don't think we should lose track of the fact that the speed of business needs to be the speed of background checks.
And just to within our own system, particularly around marijuana, you know, you can be associated with several different license types, several different ownerships. And in some cases, we get the same people there, right? Now, we have a little time frame, I believe I can get you it, where we use the singular background check and can do it. Also, I want to just share with the committee, and you know this, we were welcoming and pulling this industry together to be able to get it licensed, up, running, generating revenue, and being in place. Our general background against crimes, felony crimes, or significant crimes, misdemeanors, and others, not the marijuana crimes that the legislature excluded from our consideration, some of the others, we generally look back 5 years, which is pretty comparable to alcohol. We're going to move that back now because we do have more time. We've got an industry up and running. We're moving back to a 7-year look as we move forward. That's our intention. So we'll be doing a little bit more. The other thing that we will be doing in background checks is there's a federal designation of career criminality. And really the way we looked at the background checks, we probably didn't see that because we first look at years and passage of time there. But now we're looking for those multiple offenders across crime types that fall into this federal category that we will now try to exclude from licensure.
One last Please. Comment. I think having some consistency in those background checks would be really important because some background checks pick up a misdemeanor shoplifting that was ultimately dropped 17 years ago. You're going back 7. I don't know across the spectrum of background checks whether it's unique to each type. If you're dealing with school children or minors, whether that's different from dealing with marijuana.
Sure.
And we might want to just flag for sort of general consideration in looking at background checks. How do we find some consistency so that that misdemeanor 17 years ago, it doesn't that charge doesn't haunt them the rest of their lives?
Yeah. And we do have inconsistencies in our process. Another part, even when you can see it, when you're doing a full nationwide background check, a lot of the background checks are just in-state, and it's cheaper to do, and there's a reason we do that. We're doing full nationwide checks on these folks. Well, their crime structures don't always align with our understanding of what it is. So if we're going to exclude someone based on those crimes, we got to actually go to the courts and get some records to be able to determine what that crime actually, how it counts in our system at some times. It's an extensive process when you're trying to prove up and use that as evidence to exclude someone from a license.
We good, Senator?
We're good.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg. Director Marks had a question related to our the current applications coming through for growers, et cetera, and I want to find out what your take is related to us having an overabundance of production, and if all of our product stays in state, do we have a potential for a black market, or are we going to get into some trouble federally? And I didn't see it on the schedule here, so I just
Mr. Chair, in. Representative Meek, I'll take a crack at that answer, and I think you'll understand the complexity and be somewhat dissatisfied by it. the reality, so in our system, we've produced a lot of wet weight marijuana. We're learning about how much it dries. We're learning about variations in drying times by strain type even, and there I've seen evidence of a pretty significant variation. We have a new market where people are innovating products and growing consumption. So I don't have the evidence to tell you that just in our legal system what we produced and what consumers of Oregon are buying, I don't have enough information to definitively tell you that we have overproduction inside our own system. I suspect we do, and that will be a problem. A lot of it is being made into oils. Oils store over a long period of time. I also don't have a lot of evidence there may be out there, and we're going to have more enforcement happening in the state, both, I think, from law enforcement and our oversight. I don't have a lot of evidence of criminal diversions off of our grow sites today, and we have some. We've had some, and we've closed those businesses, or they've settled out or otherwise gone off. In every case where there has been an instance of diversion, so that's not the complete answer. We will be doing, and Bill's done a lot of work looking at this with our analysts inside the agency, we will be providing you a report prior to next session so that you can look at the production issue. You know, this is our first really sort of normalized year of sales and consumption. We're also having some interplays of the market. A lot of licensees are failing out. They're beginning to fail out. The strains of the system, unless you're well capitalized, the legal market is not as lucrative as the illicit markets that are out there. So that's all to tell you that we're going to get you more information. We're going to be more transparent in trying to get more information about production out on our website, and we will have a report and take to heart the U.S. Attorney's strong interest in overproduction. I do think that a lot of the numbers that we hear conflate other production other than the state's just legal system, and it's hard to distinguish that amongst the noise and data.
And follow up, co-chair,
please.
And thank you, Director Marks. And while I was on the we're on the topic of enforcement, I know we had some issues with some my biggest concern is that we're getting some of this product into the hands of minors, and I know that you had some issues with some compliance issues of selling to minors, and I know we have some, or you have, I was a retailer for beer and wine back in the 90s, and it was my biggest concern to get in trouble for serving. I didn't ever want to lose a day of operation because I couldn't barely afford my lease if I made some of these mistakes. And so I want to make sure that, or I'd like to hear from you, what are some of your, and I know this is not a policy committee, but I would like to just get on the record to find out what, if you haven't spoke with other legislators, about what safeguards you've put into place or what other things we can enforce to make sure that we don't get this product into minors' hands.
So, co-chair and Representative Meek, excuse me. We have done a lot of work around packaging, labeling, the naming, the appeal of the packaging to children. We've have a universal symbol on the packaging, so we've done a lot. Packages have to, several of the product types have to go out in child-resistant, resealable packages. So they're resistant on closure again after you go out. That doesn't apply to all products, some of the single-serving ones, unless we have different packaging requirements. But we've looked. We have lower dosages to help with the safety factor in our recreational system. And I'm not sure, I haven't kept pace with all of Colorado and Washington's changes, but when we initially started, we were amongst the lowest for how much you could take out and package in a single package in the recreational market. We have seen, and we got out in December, got our protocols in place, did the trainings, and went out and did minor decoy operations for marijuana retailers. Probably our first really enforcement. There's been some complaint-based enforcement going on, but systemic enforcement at the retail level. We had abysmal results from that work. Washington and Colorado's sales to minor stats are much better. They're in the high 90s, and they're better than what we experienced for alcohol. Alcohol, we kind of bumped from 79 to like 83% on sales. Now, remember, that covers thousands of more. It also covers service, and there's no service in this marijuana industry right now. Our first range, we were at, let me just pull it up. Our press release went out today about our second round of numbers just as we were sitting here. And we are at, we're at 81% overall. Last time, we now are at 89% for this round. So we're seeing the improvement. They heard our message. We increased the penalty to in the $4,000 range for first-time offenses on this. The workers and their permits also are subject to a penalty. So we've treated it seriously. I think we're beginning to see the conditioning work through the system. I'm not ready to say it's there. In fact, I definitely say in the press release that we're not there yet. But it looks to me like we're getting good response. I hope it continues, and I'd like to see it in the mid-90s or higher. Now, people have said to alcohol that it made the comparison. Why are we so low in alcohol, and why do we tolerate that? And that, I think, is a very fair question. And one of the things that I want us to look at, and one of the things I think you'll see as we come back to next session, is we need to get back to looking at what we're doing in our alcohol program and with enforcement and what's acceptable there.
Thank you, Representative you. And Director. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what Mr. Marks's presentation looks like, but having the chair of your board in the room is an honor, and I wanted to make sure, Mr. Chair, that if Mr. Rosenbaum had anything to say, that it could be included, and he would have the opportunity to offer comments. If
thank you, Senator Johnson. Maybe 1 minute at the very end. That's
all right. Why don't we do that?
Yep.
Very good. Thank you. And I know that wasn't picked up by the microphones, but the indication was that at the very end we'd take just a minute.
Great. Should I continue? We try our more questions now. Continue on with the presentation. So we'll go through the explanation of the budget items. The last one that I didn't cover here, I believe, was the geographic information system. We send funds to OHA that provides the service to look at how close a retail facility is to a school. 1,000 feet is generally it. There's exceptions if there's barriers. They provide us that service. It wasn't fully funded through the biennium, so we're asking for some more money to continue that service that they provide us. And I'll start off on the budget items, and then Bill will pick up here. You've heard a lot about me about this, but I think the recent audit report on IT really hammers home that we need to elevate our management expertise on IT inside of OLCC. We were working hard to get there. This position will give us a great advantage to do the kind of planning that we need to do into the future, not just for marijuana and those experiences we have around cannabis tracking and the privilege tax, but at some point in the near future, we've got to plan and execute a project to modernize our financial systems and our warehouse management systems and all the logistics that go into that vital function, and that's all about our ability to collect and retain and count and account for bottles and dollars and be able to do the transfers of compensation to folks and be able to do the transfers to the general fund. A big part of business, and I'll just remind you on the alcohol side, Bill will correct me if I'm a little wrong here, I think we're at 4% administration. That's remarkable, and we're going to need a little capital funds to fund these projects going forward. But the basis here is that that we really need our strategic implementation technology. I've told you we lack the expertise to manage our IT. We are working through. We've been able to get by and manage the projects that we have. We've had criticism on some lax oversight and audit, and I don't disagree with that because we really haven't had what we need to get the job done. This will put us a long ways to make that happen. Representative Nierman, got a letter from the CIO, Alex Pettit, supporting this position for the budget, and this will move us forward a long way. And I just want to emphasize, we had the opening of our IT director. We spent a lot of time getting an individual hired. He was with us for about 2 or 3 days. He had sold out of his company and a merger. They gave him a bunch of equity and pulled him out. 2 days later, he's gone. Hard to keep people in this field right now. So I'll just turn it over to Bill to move to the next item if there are no questions there.
Very good. Welcome.
For the record, Bill Schuette, Chief Financial Officer for the Liquor Control Commission. I'll go through the next items that we're requesting. The next one, system-wide information technology. We had a plan to develop a redundancy hot site at our secondary location, our second warehouse known as Millport. Last winter, we had several weather and electrical events that threatened operations of both liquor warehouses. A redundancy site would basically enable, if the servers went down on one site, that they could be brought up immediately on a secondary site and service the rest of the agency. In the request letter, we asked for funding for both new servers and disk storage to meet the urgent operational needs of this. Our plan at the time was to try to go a little cheaper and use some of the older servers, unsupported servers, to be redeployed up at our Millport facility for backup. However, after consultation with CIO's office and Legislative Fiscal Office, Technology Officer, and as a result of the Secretary of State audit that came up with some specific findings on that, replacing unsupported servers and disaster recovery were identified as a priority for the state. So we're rethinking that plan. The agency plans to seek guidance from agency CIO position if hired, state CIO, Legislative Fiscal Office. We'd like to move forward with an e-board for both the immediate request to replacing unsupported servers and implementing a comprehensive disaster recovery plan. This is to say that our servers are not backed up. They are backed up on a data percent that we can, another separate storage site that we can recreate the data in the systems, but it takes a day or two to do that if they go down.
Senator.
I just want to understand this CIO position. As many times as Mr. Marks has discussed this with me, I want to make sure that this is an independent CIO for your operation at OLCC and that we're not bucking up Alex Pettit's shop. Bucking up is a technical term. Adding personnel to the state CIO.
Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson. We have requested an independent position. There may be some advantages for us to have a working alliance with the CIO's office on this, with clear charge that the work done for the CIO's for us is under our control. And I will, since it's very, I'm hoping to be able to actually shore up our overall emphasis and attention to do the job that we need to do with modernization here. So I'm hedging my words here a bit, but I will assure you that I will inform you of how we employ this person and deploy them once they're in place.
College, I just want to make sure that we don't get schnookered here. The CIO is consolidating an enormous amount of, for lack of a better word, power in that CIO shop. And I just want to make sure that in support of OLCC, we know exactly what we're buying.
Thank you, Senator. That's two technical terms in one question. Representative Nierman.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first of all, I'll confirm I did get a letter from the state CIO outlining some of the reasons why you your operation needs a its own CIO. So I was happy to get that. I can share that with the committee if you like, too. So on this... backup servers and just data storage in general, I hope that you give consideration to third-party cloud systems as well as the state data center. I think that we need to take all of those into consideration. I get nervous about the putting a server underneath the roof that we just paid to have fixed there or whatever. So, but hopefully you'll consider third-party cloud services as one option to go
Chair
forward.
Chair Gomberg, Rep. Newman, exactly. We had, you know, this backup that we were working on. We were just looking to change a couple server boxes to run the same functions because they're operationally important to us and they were unsupported. But we need the near-term redundancy. We thought it might be cost-effective to redeploy the unsupported servers to provide us quick near-term backup, but we fully will be looking at off-site third-party servers in our business plans. It may be a two-step process where we do something now, and next session we migrate the system to remote servers.
Good, thank you.
Around six or nine.
Continuing on, our next request, DAS required SAP software upgrade. SAP is a baseline software that serves to function for most of our financial services, order processing, regulatory warehouse. It's used by a lot of entities. It's used by a lot of other state agencies. SAP has a statewide agreement with Oregon. DAS informed us earlier this year that they need to renew those licenses, and those licenses are going to cost more money. So we're requesting additional funds for the new licenses to be implemented into our systems.
Thank you. And colleagues, I note I think we've got six slides to go, and we've got about 12 minutes, and we did want to reserve a little time at the very end. So I welcome your questions, but let's keep moving.
Okay. I'll try to speed it up here. System-wide information technology, a few requests here. As Ms. Deister mentioned, online privilege tax technical fix, House Bill 2150 is requiring us to develop an online reporting and payment system for our beer and wine systems, beer and wine payment tax collections. Expenditure limitation needed for preliminary planning of the system is estimated at $300,000 to develop the business requirements, the RFPs. This will go through the stage-gated process. We did try to go out for what they call an RFI, request for information. We only got two responses out of that. Very wide range of estimates. We do need to implement this by June 30th, so the plan moving forward is to use these resources to develop the actual RFP or request for proposals. Those generally have more responses, better cost estimates, and coming back to you in a future estimate e-board with those cost estimates to get your approval, hopefully. As Mr. Marks mentioned, this is the big one, OHA medical marijuana tracking implementation as a result of Senate Bill 1057. It requires OHA medical grow sites over 12 plants, but it also includes a smaller number of processing sites, dispensaries to be tracked by the OLCC's cannabis tracking system. In the last budget, we did receive seven positions for startup when we're directed to return in February for the regulatory specialists themselves. December 7, 2017, there was a deadline to OHA for all growers and participants in the OHA system to declare their intent, whether they're going to remain in the system and be tracked by OLCC, apply for an OLCC license, or drop out of the system. The numbers are a little iffy at this point, but at this point we've had 1,700 declare their intention to remain in OHA and be tracked. 300 have declared their intention to be seek an OLCC license. There is a large population out there that did not respond. We estimate that of the 2,000 that responded so far, there might be 5,000 total that could be estimated to qualify. So, but for this purpose of requesting funds using our formulary, as was directed before, of 150 regulatory specialists per one regulatory specialist for each 150 registrants, requesting 13 positions, total request of $2.2 million. Also requesting that, and this is not part of the $2 million, that OHA does collect a tracking fee that transfers funds for the medical or tracking system. There's a $40 per month tracking fee assessed to the registrants. We pay that on the recreational side, but on the medical side, they'll be paying that to OHA. They will remit that to us, and we will pass it through to Metric, which is our contractor for the cannabis tracking system. And the next one, marijuana licensing renewal and support. As Mr. Marks indicated, we're requesting administrative support positions, three positions for assisting the licensing unit with the manual components of renewal process. The backlog does continue to grow. We want to try to at least stay even if we can. This is not intended to speed licenses, but work on the existing workload. Currently, we have now a total of 1,739 licenses with almost an equal amount that are pending in the system. And then the final request, as Mr. Marks also mentioned, is geographic information system. When our marijuana system started, OHA already had a medical GIS program in place. GIS is geographical information system that maps locations and schools and churches. At that point, we decided to enter into an interagency agreement with OHA. as a cost savings and basically piggyback our recreational system onto their existing medical system. What has happened since then is the medical system applicants have greatly almost dried up completely, and a lot of that has been moved to the recreational system, and now this half-time position basically is working full-time for OLCC. But since we still think it's a cost-effective means, we want to use the shared services program between OHA and DHS, which has a pretty extensive GIS unit, to continue this service.
So I'll take us on a sprint here. There's hemp legislation going forward. It looks a lot like marijuana, smells a lot like marijuana, grows at larger grows than most marijuana sites, is regulated by ODA. They want to be in our system, and we provided them one route in the last session of the legislature. Now they want to be, now we're going to have responsibilities to track designated amounts of from the growers their product into our system and modify metric, and we'll metric track it through our system just like we do marijuana to our retail. They want to be in our market. Some of that is because they produce high CBDs out of the product, and CBDs are very marketable but unable to be sold outside of our regulated market. We have legislation that provides technical fixes to the our marijuana programs. Primarily, these changes help us to identify OHA growers more clearly so that we can have our tracking system actually track them easier, know what a grow site is, and know the location of the grow sites. Importantly, and I say the most important feature and the most important act you will do this session, if you move it forward, is this bill establishes the Illegal Marijuana Market Enforcement Program. This is targeted funds to help us in problem areas where enforcement is lacking, where we're lacking prosecution, to go after criminal activity, whether it emanates from within our system and our licensees, or is it part of the illegal market. There's nothing more reinforcing to the recreational system and its integrity today than to make sure we have the reinforcement of illegal activity being prosecuted. And I don't know that they've got dollars in the bill. I understand we've been talking somewhere around $3 million devoted to this activity. This would be funded off the same dollars that our OHA tracking is, off the marijuana tax dollars through the administrative fund. Very important part of the program, very supportive of that, and I actually believe this is the singular most important thing you'll do to help us regulate marijuana in the state of Oregon. Growing and adapting, I won't belabor this slide at all. A lot more to come on marijuana, on growing the program, on growing our management and organization of that. We're going to be asking for higher fees to cover more inspectors out there to make sure we have the kind of program that has the integrity that the legislature and citizens want us to have. We're going to have to refocus and reshift, I've mentioned this, back to figuring out what added features we want to do in alcohol enforcement, and to make sure we shore up revenue generation and continue to carry out an expansion program that's reasonable. And then we're going to come to you for capital investments in technology and our basic infrastructure to roll it forward. And with that, I think the chairman's got a couple minutes.
Very good. Colleagues, any questions? Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Are those marijuana plants? ones with the trunks?
I do not believe so. I think those are hemp.
they hidden larger grow behind those trees.
I'll also thank the CFO for joining us today. And Mr. Rosenbaum, we've got about 4 minutes, but we're delighted to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
As quick as time as I can. My name is Paul Rosenbaum, and I'm chairman of the OLCC. For those of you who don't know me, In a proxy fight, I took a small little distribution company and turned it into one of the major information management companies in the world. Very successful on it, and the whole thing was IT. Whoever owns the data owns the world. So when I decided to take this job as chairman, I spent a lot of time with Mr. Marks and with his staff, and I had to be convinced that they knew what they were doing before I took the job, because my job is not to work day to day with the agency. They're wonderful, they're smart, and I'm not saying that, I truly believe it. Here's the last line of this thing. It took us $30 million to get to the point to bring the IT up to where we needed to go in order to do what we wanted to do. You're looking at $500,000. Senator Johnson talked about the fact that there, what do you do to prioritize that you don't do that? There's $101,000 in here for an administrative service director whose specific jobs are to find out what the priorities from everything down the line. Pretty cheap price to pay for it when you're looking about what you're concerned about. One of the representatives talked about the fact that he was concerned about background requirements. One of the things is a direct information technology person can do that and write it in code in somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes if you do it right. Everything in this world today, everything is, if you don't figure 5 years down the road of what's going to happen, you're going to fail. It's changing so fast that you have to understand what's coming down the pipe. I'm being very honest about this. Spend small little amounts of money to get new servers in here. They're incredibly important. Spend the small little amounts of money to take a look at the secondary. If I didn't have a secondary location, our secondary location was in Orlando from Oregon. Why? Because if we went down, we were dead. You're talking about huge amounts of money, but if you take care of what is in the budget now at a relatively small price, the reason why I came on this job, it's exciting to me beyond belief. And the reason I did that is that if you take care of these things right now for a relatively small amount of money, Oregon is on the forefront, the very forefront. We're years ahead of any other state, including Colorado, in what we can do, because whoever owns the data owns the world. I took this job because I want to bring in additional revenue to the state of Oregon, a lot. And how do you do it? You first spend 6 months in putting this together. There's nothing wrong with the IT over here. It can be changed and quickly fixed. Once we have that done, we create data. We create reports. We create a system in this state that is worth a bloody fortune for the world. My job right now is why I'm excited about it, is that take care of the small little features that we're asking for, and they are small compared to the $1.5 billion biennium. That $107 million could probably close to be $500 million in a short period of time. We have to track it, law enforcement, but more important, I promise you, I want to come back to you in a year from now or less and tell you exactly the plans I have in my head today to raise a huge amount of money in terms of data that we can sell across the entire world. That's all I got to say.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Senator Johnson.
I would just close by saying I have the great privilege of knowing the chair outside of this environment, and I can attest to the veracity of his comments, and we would it would behoove us to listen to him.
Thank you so much. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the information hearing. Ms. Deister, do we have anything else?
That's it for today.
We will be back, same bat time, same bat station. Indeed. All right, then thank you, everyone, for appearing today, and we are adjourned.
You're saying we're